Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 186 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Cebulski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. It's always challenging to try to retrace the everyday steps of people who lived more than 500 years ago, and when it comes to the 50% of the population that was medieval women, it can be even trickier. We know that women worked and contributed in vital ways to their families and communities, but where do we find the evidence? And what can it tell us about the lives of women from different faiths? This week, I spoke with Dr. Sarah Ift-Decker about her research into women's work in medieval Iberia. Sarah is an assistant professor of history at Rhodes College and the author of many articles and book chapters on Jewish and Christian women, marriage, conversion, and money in Catalonia. She's also the creator and host of Media Evil, a medieval pop culture podcast. Her new book is The Fruit of Her Hands, Jewish and Christian Women's Work in Medieval Catalan Cities. Our conversation on women's work in Catalonia, how we can trace it, and how it differed from city to city and faith to faith is coming up right after this.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino. With cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Well, thank you, Sarah, for joining me to talk about women's work in Catalonia. Happy to have you here, a fellow podcaster, to talk about her work.
So glad to be joining you. Thank you for having me.
So for people who don't know, because I never want to assume anything, where is Catalonia? Can you tell us about where it is and what period you're talking about when you're looking at these records?
So I'm looking at the region that's in the northeast of what is now Spain. And just, of course, as a reminder for listeners who aren't necessarily familiar, the reason I'm saying what is now Spain is that Spain was not a country in the Middle Ages, so that this region and the period that I'm looking at, which is 1250 to 1350, belong to an entity called the Crown of Aragon, which is a federative monarchy that is a lot of northern and eastern, again, what is now Spain, as well as kind of parts of what's now Italy, southern France, and even actually Greece for some of this period.
So it is a different sort of flavor than Spain today. I mean, we need to establish that before we get started, right?
Yes, yes. And this is also a region where even today that Spanish is not necessarily the kind of primary language that many people there prefer. Catalan, which is a Romance language that in fact developed separately from Castilian, which is what became what is now Spanish.
Right. Okay. So now we know where we are. We know when we are. So your book looks a lot at, well, it's mainly focused on women in Christian and Jewish communities in Catalonia in three major cities. So what are the cities you're looking at for this book?
So I looked at the cities of Barcelona, Girona, and Vic, which I did because I wanted to kind of get a sense of cities that varied in size and economic profile. If you've heard of a city in Catalonia, it is probably Barcelona. Mm-hmm. Barcelona, of course, both in the Middle Ages and today, is a major city, a really vibrant city, a cultural center, and really an economic powerhouse. And Andoc also was kind of functioning as the capital of the Crown of Aragon, essentially. And then I looked at Girona, which is a kind of mid-sized city, still, I would say, one that's kind of fairly economically important. It tends to get mentioned as in the kind of second tier of cities in Catalonia after Barcelona, which is sort of its own tier. and then looked at Vík, which is a kind of sort of mid-sized city, a bit smaller, and wanted to kind of get a sense of what things were like in a city that isn't, you know, that's still, I would say, you would call a city, but isn't one of the kind of major cities of the region to quite the same extent. And they're also all cities that jumped out to me because, first of all, because I'm interested in both Jews and Christians. So I, first of all, had to make sure to be looking at cities that actually had a Jewish community of some note, which especially as you get into the kind of smaller cities is not necessarily something guaranteed, or at least that it's not necessarily a well-documented Jewish community. But also that all of these cities are ones that, as I'm sure we'll talk about more, are cities that are really rich in their surviving documentation. And that was one of the things actually that drew me to Vík in particular, is that it has a really, really amazing documentation, that it's the smallest of the three cities, but it actually has the kind of most extensive amount of records surviving of the cities that I looked at.
And this is never a given. So you have to go where the sources are, right?
Yes.
Okay. And one more thing I think we should establish before we go on is that these cities at this time, they are led by Christians, right? Because there's lots of places in Iberia that over the Middle Ages are ruled by Islamic rulers and then sometimes Christian rulers. So the time period you're looking at, in the area you're looking at, it's Christianity that is in charge when it comes to administration, right?
Yes. So Catalonia, especially when you're talking about kind of old Catalonia, which all of these cities would fall under that heading, actually spent very, very little time under Muslim rule. And so these are cities that are Christian ruled, have been for a long time. And I'll note, since I say I'm talking about Jewish and Christian women, that there's really not much of a Muslim population. There's some in Barcelona, not really any as far as we know in the other two cities that I'm looking at. And to the extent, actually, that I come across Muslims in the documentation that I'm looking at, I actually mostly come across enslaved Muslims. Mm-hmm. So we're not seeing a significant of a Muslim presence in this particular area as you would in other parts of what's now Spain.
Okay, thanks for establishing that for us. And when we think about Iberia in the Middle Ages, people tend to think of it as being a place where all of the religions are getting along really well, super well, the idea of convivencia, right? Can you tell us what it looked like in the cities that you're looking at in Catalonia between 1250 and 1350? What does it look like in terms of how the communities are getting along?
So I find the term convivencia really interesting in that it sometimes evokes these images that you referenced of a kind of interfaith utopia, right? Where everybody kind of sits in a circle and hugs and they all really like each other. And that's rarely, I would say, in fact, the case. But one of the things that I think is interesting about the term is that if you translate it literally, what it actually means is living together. And I think that actually kind of can function as a really accurate depiction when you just kind of think of the term convivencia and try to divorce it from these ideas of a kind of utopian harmony and instead think about it as a kind of just very sort of practical everyday accommodation of figuring out, even if you don't necessarily always especially like each other, even if there are differences that are significant, that you still figure out a way to live together in a relatively peaceful manner. And that's, I think, how I would generally describe things for most of the period that I'm looking at. I'm looking at a period where between 1250 and 1350, there are not that many outbreaks of what you would call extreme hostility between Jews and Christians. You're really not seeing anything along the kind of, you know, massacres that people talk about, for example, until the outbreak of the Black Death in 1348, that there are massacres in Barcelona in particular. And some number of years after this, in 1391, there are a wave of massacres across the Iberian Peninsula that also involve a number of mass conversions of Jews. And that is very much not quite, I would say, the dynamic in the mid-13th and early 14th centuries, that it is this kind of relatively peaceful accommodation. Now, that doesn't mean that everybody really, really likes each other, but that what I tend to see in the documentation that I have is a lot of kind of relatively neutral, at least economic interaction that people might still hold, that, for example, you know, as a Christian, you might still hold the idea that you think the Jews killed Jesus. Mm-hmm. You might still believe that and have negative feelings toward Jews as a result of that. But that doesn't actually, I think, necessarily always come out if you're buying property from a Jew or borrowing money from a Jew or even actually potentially living next door to a Jew. It's not something that's necessarily going to always show up in big ways, at least in your everyday life.
Yeah. I think that is a good way of putting it, where it's relatively peaceful, but that doesn't mean that there isn't tension at times.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the tension doesn't have to be there all the time. Every day is just people living side by side, as people do.
Mm-hmm. And the tensions that I think are there, I think are often coming out in probably kind of really small ways. I mean, I think there are ways in which potentially, you know, maybe as a Jew walking into certain settings that are primarily Christian, that you don't always feel 100% comfortable, that it's a moment where you question perhaps whether you are entirely safe, whether you are going to be treated well. And that doesn't necessarily mean that something is always going to happen, but that the circumstances and the tensions are there such that there is a level perhaps of discomfort that you're experiencing as a member of this minority community.
Yeah. And I think that discomfort, as you've said in the book, plays out in some ways when we look at the records that you have showing mm-hmm. the interactions between people and communities. So the very last thing I'm going to ask you before we get into those sources are, in these cities, how are people living together? So when they're living side by side, are they separated in the idea that we have of a Jewish quarter, perhaps, or even a ghetto? Or are they, the two communities, integrated when it comes to living space?
First of all, I'll say I'm going to first kind of mostly talk about Barcelona and Girona and then get into Vic. So in Barcelona and Girona, both of these are cities with pretty long-standing Jewish communities by the mid-13th century. And so in both of those cities, there are Jewish quarters. They're Jewish quarters that have walls. But Jews are not required to live in the Jewish quarter, and Christians are not banned from living in the Jewish quarter. We have references where it seems like we have Jews who live outside the Jewish quarter. We certainly have Jews who own property outside the Jewish quarter. We also can see that there are Christians who are at least buying property in the Jewish quarter, and it seems like in some cases are actually buying or leasing property for their personal residences. So this is not an isolated community, that even with the existence of a Jewish quarter, there's some amount of mixing in terms of residential neighborhoods. And in Vic, because we're looking at a Jewish community that's pretty new in the period that I'm looking at, that really the kind of first references to Jews in Vic come in around the 1230s, that because of that, we actually don't, in the beginning of the period that I'm looking at, have an actual kind of well-defined Jewish quarter. And it seems like Jews and Christians are really very much intermingling as this Jewish community first starts to become established.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks for establishing that for us, because I think when we are going to be talking about women's work and the way people are interacting, mm-hmm. I think it's important to visualize whether these people are seeing each other every day on the street, on the way to get groceries, all of that kind of stuff. So thanks for spelling that out for us. Okay. Let's get into the records, because for this, you were looking at notarial records. Tell us what notarial records are.
Yeah. So first I'll take a step back and explain who notaries are, first of all. Especially because if you live in a kind of Anglo-American context, you might have heard of a notary, but notaries in the medieval Mediterranean are pretty different. So the notaries that I'm talking about are people who are both legal professionals and public authorities. So legal professionals means that they're people who have specialized training and are able to draw up legally valid contracts according to some amount of kind of standard legalese. But there's also, especially when you get into longer contracts, some amount of additional work that has to be done in order to kind of make the contract fit the perhaps kind of more specific wishes of the clients. So these are people who essentially kind of function as at least kind of some kinds of lawyers, in fact, do today, right? That these are the people that you would go to draw up a loan contract, to draw up a will, to draw up a, you know, real estate sale contract, and that they have the expertise to make sure that there's no legal issues with this contract. They also are people who are public authorities, that they are appointed by royal authority or by the authority of a bishop or by a municipal government. And this means that essentially by their intervention, by their kind of drawing up and authorizing this contract, they are transforming it from a private arrangement into a public and legally enforceable fact. And notaries, I would say, still, I guess, have that function in some ways in the Anglo-American context, that you kind of go to a notary today and, you know, the notary will kind of put a stamp on something and then you kind of send it in to finalize your car registration or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, we still see notaries having that function in our context today, but that in this context, it was kind of much broader as well. And the notaries in the period that I'm looking at start not only having the copies of the contracts that they give to their clients, which are generally on parchment and in their nicest handwriting, but they also have records that they keep just for themselves. And so they have these large books, which are on paper. They're actually some of the oldest paper documents in Europe. And that these books then record their own copies of the contracts, which are generally then in their worst handwriting and also are heavily, heavily abbreviated. So they're an interesting experience to work with from that regard. But also, I would say, kind of really fascinating and a little bit different from what you might anticipate when people traditionally think about medieval history, in that people often think about the Middle Ages as an era where we have a paucity of sources, whereas I, in contrast, have, if anything, far too many sources, because there are a lot of these notarial registers, these books that are looking at. So each of the three cities that I looked at has hundreds of these books available, between about 150 and 300 per city, just for this 100-year period of 1250 to 1350. And each of these individual books has hundreds of contracts. So I, in total, I kind of did the math out on this for something that I was kind of doing with some of my students recently. I think I looked at, in total, about 20,000 contracts.
Well, hats off to you, because that is a lot of work.
Yes. Yes. So just a lot of documents that I have at my disposal and wasn't even able to look at anything. There's just so much out there.
Which begs the question, how did you decide which ones to look at?
Yeah. So I actually adopted a strategy of random sampling, which I actually talked to an economist about when I was first getting started with this project, and basically kind of divided up the available registers by city and by decade in order to make sure that I had a spread and didn't end up kind of accidentally looking at, you know, only a bunch of registers from the 1330s and not seeing anything else, but then use that to essentially decide which registers I was going to look at, was by kind of using this strategy. I also have some kind of exceptions to that. So that, for example, in Vic, essentially in general, just because there are fewer Jews than Christians, there tend to be, you know, fewer total documents you find involving Jews. So when I have the opportunity, I want to kind of make sure I'm getting all of the information that's available about the Jewish community. So in Vic, the notaries actually kept most of the contracts involving Jews in a separate set of registers called the Libri Judaeorum, which literally means books of the Jews. Mm-hmm. And there are 28 of those, dating from, the earliest is from right about 12, they actually go conveniently right about from 1250 to 1350. So I looked at all of those in Vic, but, you know, so there are kind of exceptions here and there. But in general, I kind of had this random sampling strategy as a way to figure out what I was going to look for.
Well, I think it's important to think about this. And also for the people who, sometimes we have people listening to the podcast that are just coming up and they're thinking like, how am I going to do this research as well? Random sampling has been used at least recently as a good way of looking at these records because there are so many of them.
Yes, there are a lot.
Okay. So when you're looking at them, you're mentioning that there's a separate set of contracts for Jews. That's because the legal guidelines around what they can do and who can do what are slightly different for these two communities, right? Between Christians and Jews.
So there are certainly kind of some distinctions in legal guidelines. I would say in terms of why they're kind of keeping the separate registers, I would say kind of to some extent has to do mostly with, and we kind of touched on this earlier, right, that there is a sense of Jews as being a kind of legally and socially distinct minority group, so that it kind of felt natural to segregate, essentially, Jewish contracts into these designated registers. It's not the only thing for which there are kind of specialized registers. There's actually also specialized registers for marriage contracts, for example. And it's different in different cities. The notaries in Vic seem to have been very invested in kind of getting things organized in this particular way, whereas in Barcelona and Girona, things tend to be more mingled together. But that this is a kind of decision that they made is essentially, okay, that this community is kind of functioning as its own distinct entity that has a kind of distinct legal relationship to public authorities. And that because of that, it makes sense for their records to be kept separately.
Perfect. So what you're looking at in the book is women's work. And so this is a place where you've said in the book that sometimes it's difficult to find women in the notarial records because this might not be their favorite place to go, is to visit the notarial office, visit the notary. Why might this be a place where they don't want to hang out so much? Why might this be a place that women might want to avoid, the notary's office?
Yeah. So when you're actually kind of looking through the contracts, it's made very clear that even though I have a lot of individual examples of women, again, because I looked at thousands of these things, that still it's very clear if you're kind of going through, you know, say the records that are, you know, okay, this is everybody, all the contracts that the notary drew up over the course of the day, and that these might have been in an office space, it might have been in a kind of, you know, in a particular neighborhood, but that it creates this impression of this sort of crowd of men around the notary, who himself would have always been a man. The public notaries were required to be male and were also required to be Christian, if you're talking about the notaries who are drawing things up in Latin and who are serving both of these communities. And so you can kind of understand why, if we're talking at a kind of male-dominated physical or even conceptual space, that it's not necessarily something that women would have felt as comfortable entering, especially if you're talking about entering that space alone, that often when we see women present in the notarial documentation, it's women who are accompanied by male family members. So their husband, their father, their brother. And that's often how they access the notaries, is through these kind of male family members. And then when you bring in Jewish women in particular, there's a couple things that are striking. One is that it's not only a kind of male space, but a Christian space, that Jews, you know, make different choices, that there are certainly Jews who, for various reasons, depending on the kind of work they do, have to develop some kind of familiarity with the notaries. But if you're going to the notary, there are very possibly not going to be very many Jews around. You might be, you know, a Jewish woman there being surrounded by Christian men. One can understand why that might feel less than comfortable. And also that Jewish women are less likely to have had experience early in their lives with the notaries. That Christian women, I think there's a kind of interesting sort of push-pull effect, that on the one hand, there are these ways in which you can see that they might feel less comfortable. But on the other hand, the notaries aren't entirely unfamiliar, especially because a lot of young women would have gone to the notary and would at least have kind of seen what this process looked like relatively early in life, both because we have a lot of contracts where Christian unmarried young women are actually signing off on things like real estate sales that their parents are making, because it affects their, because, you know, their inheritance rights are recognized, and this can affect their inheritance if they're selling off family property. And also that a lot of these young women are then going to the notary, at least when they get married. And of course, they're, you know, doing so once again, certainly in the company of men. They're doing so, you know, with their husband, with their father, sometimes with a whole group of other people. But they are going and seeing what this process is like, whereas Jewish girls are much less likely to do that. We have relatively few contracts in which we actually see unmarried Jewish women or Jewish women getting married in the documentation.
Right. And one of the places I thought was really interesting in the book that you talk about, one of the times in which you might have a woman who is just basically coming out of girlhood showing up at the notarial office, is to become an apprentice. So we have apprenticeship records. Tell us about those.
Yes. So I have a lot of those. And first of all, I will note that all of the ones I have are Christians, that there actually are not any records of Jewish girls who are apprenticing. But that, yes, I have this collection of records, which are young women, and most of them are apprenticing with women, not all of them, but a majority of them are actually apprenticing with women. And so we kind of see this interesting process of these networks of women training women in various trades. These are mostly within the textile industries, so at various levels. So we see a lot of seamstresses, we see weavers, we see sometimes very specialized things. Like, I think at some point there's somebody who's like a weaver of silk headdresses specifically is, you know, taking on an apprentice. But that, yes, that you have these young women, and they're often actually coming from rural areas into the cities. And this is potentially also is perhaps functioning as a kind of form of social mobility. It seems possible that, you know, it's could be perceived as an opportunity that, you know, you're kind of gaining this skill that could mean that you're ideally going to kind of be able to eventually establish your own workshop, have your own business, essentially. It could also mean that it's, you know, something that maybe makes you a good candidate for marriage, whether because you can contribute to the household in terms of actually having that kind of formal work, or just in the sense of, well, this person is apprenticed with a seamstress, I know that she can fix my clothes. That this is a kind of training that would then be perceived as being valuable, whether for providing things that would be seen as domestic labor, or for, you know, being able to work and bring in an income into the household.
Yeah, I was talking with Marion Turner a few weeks ago. We were talking about the life of Bath and women working and how you might work in domestic service as well as a way to sort of train yourself up to run your own household, as well as to make some money. And you found some domestic contracts as well in the records, right?
Yes, I found domestic service contracts as well. The other thing that I will just kind of note in this context, although it's a sort of slightly different group of women, of course, are I also have wet nursing contracts. Mm-hmm. So that if you're in a lead woman, you very possibly would make the choice, or you or your husband or some combination of the two of you might make the choice that you are not going to breastfeed your own child. You're instead going to hire someone to do that for you. And also, of course, that there are contexts in which you would instead have an enslaved woman who might do that for you. Mm-hmm. So I have a number of contracts where it's actually that the women themselves are hiring other women to breastfeed their children.
I think that's really interesting. And especially when you have these contracts for especially young girls, where it may be a small bit of protection when they're moving mm-hmm. into someone's household. And one of the things that jumped out at me in the book was that sometimes you would have an apprentice that would be accepted into a married couple's home, but not a widow's home, because for some mm-hmm. reason, people thought a widow couldn't take care of a young girl the way a married couple could. I thought this was probably pretty interesting on lots of different levels.
Yeah, that I think there is at least a perception, right, that these married couples are kind of more likely to be financially stable. And that's something that's, I would say, part perception and part truth. That we do often get a sense that when we're talking about widows who are not at the upper echelons of society, that widowhood on the one hand can theoretically bring freedom, but it also carries a lot of financial risk, both because women's work is often not as valued as men's work. And so, you know, you're potentially not going to be able to bring in as much of an income, or also simply because you used to have two earners and now you have one. Mm-hmm. So that there are various kinds of issues that get raised there in terms of, you know, you can understand why parents who are placing a young child, you know, some of these girls could be as young as like 7, 8, or 9. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're placing a child in a household, that you want to make sure that they're actually going to be able to feed and clothe your child in the long term.
I mean, it's definitely a concern that you would have as a parent. And yeah. I'm always emphasizing the fact that people did love their children back in the
yes,
day.
Yes.
Wanting to provide for them. Mm-hmm. While we're talking about textiles, though, and women who are working in the trades, you do believe that Jewish women were doing the same thing, but they're not showing up in the notarial records. Why might that be?
Yeah. So one of the things that really kind of jumped out to me is that there are a couple of references that I do have to Jewish women, but that the references that I have to Jewish women are, in terms of the textile industry, are always alongside their husbands. So this suggests a couple of things. One is very possibly that Jewish women are having a harder time actually establishing independent businesses, right? Mm-hmm. That they might only really be able to kind of establish or work in workshops when they have their husband actively supporting them. But one of the things that I think is kind of a really important element is, I guess, kind of the combination of Jewish women's access to notarial culture, but also this question of access to financial resources. Jewish law is much more stringent than Catalan Christian law in this particular context about things like whether a woman who is married gets to have any control over property or over financial resources. In general, I would say in both of these communities, the expectation is that for a woman, much of your wealth is in the form of the dowry, and the dowry tends to be under the control of your husband for the duration of the marriage. On an individual level in different families, you kind of get the sense that there is some flexibility in that, but that is, I would say, by choice rather than legally per se. But then there's also the question of if you have an inheritance beyond your dowry, we're much more likely to see Christian women managing that wealth independently than Jewish women, where in fact, technically, your husband is actually still supposed to kind of be in charge of that while the marriage lasts. Mm-hmm. There are just kind of different regulations about essentially the return of that and how intensely that's kind of taken in terms of like, literally, you have to return things precisely as they were, as opposed to basically the kind of value of, or if it's, you know, been depreciated, then sort of that's not your problem. But so there's that avenue, which is at least kind of potentially closed off. And there's also the kind of interesting dynamic where there's much more of a sense within Christian legal culture of essentially that even if, yes, you're not controlling the dowry gives you a kind of claim over household assets more broadly. One of the really striking ways in which this comes out is that you actually can sue your husband for the return of the dowry if he is found to be mismanaging it, if he's about to go bankrupt, for example. That you get to sue him and that, you know, women won these suits. And then I have this really interesting case from a Hebrew responsum. This is a question sent to a rabbi and then the rabbi's ruling, where a woman has done that, And the Christian creditor that her husband owed money to says, you know, all right, fine. You know, the courts have spoken. That is what it is. But the Jewish creditor says, I don't think you can do that. And the rabbi says, yeah, no, you absolutely can't. You are not allowed to do that. You've got to pay this guy back. Mm-hmm. So you do get a sense that there are more restrictions in place about what it looks like for women to control financial resources. And so I think that's kind of part of it too, is that they're less likely to have their own resources. And also I would say are probably then, if we're talking about, say, something like commercial investments, because I have a lot of contracts, which are kind of commercial investments in small businesses, essentially, that for that reason also, you know, they're potentially seen as not being such a great risk, essentially, that because they kind of have less at their disposal to begin with, perhaps also for that reason, you know, families are less likely to, you know, send children to apprentice with, you know, a woman who would be working alone.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think this idea of small business is one that we definitely should talk about, because when we think about women having liquid cash, they're able to use it somehow. We see a lot of women investing in small business, and we see them investing in things like sea voyages. And I think this is something that perhaps we don't really think about when we think about women in the Middle Ages, that they might be embarking on financial ventures, maybe increasing their portfolio and getting investments back. So can you tell us a little bit about how you saw this happening? How did women invest their cash in order to get it back to them, do you think?
I think one of the things that we, first of all, don't always think about when we think about these kind of Mediterranean trading voyages, that often there's a kind of perception of, you know, there's somebody who's putting up all of the cash and then there's the merchants who are traveling. There's very rarely, when you actually look at this documentation, one person who's putting up all the cash. It's that you collect a bunch of investments. And that when you're talking about kind of wealthier women in particular, there are risks, of course, but it's potentially a good investment to put some money into these Mediterranean trading voyages, that if they go well, at least you could get a pretty significant return on your investment for these voyages, you know, Sardinia, the Byzantine Empire, Alexandria, you know, so that they're going all of these places and that this could potentially work out really well for you. But also, you know, we can see the merchants are often relying on their own women relatives, that they're kind of turning to these people as, okay, you know, we'd like to suggest to you that this would be a good investment. We also can kind of see networks both involving women, but also between women and men among the investors. So that, you know, maybe one person gets involved and then they're telling their family and friends, oh, you know, this seems like a pretty good plan. So you have those. But then also one of the things that I found really interesting is that when you're looking at women who are of more middling status, they're investing in local trade and local small businesses. And you even see some kind of interesting examples of people who really seem like they're like diversifying their portfolios, that I have somebody who makes a bunch of different investments in a bunch of different ventures, and they're all, you know, relatively small. And so kind of interesting to see. I mean, that is a way of reducing risk. It also could potentially end up being less profitable, but is less risky.
I love that. There was one example I think you had in there where somebody was giving some money so that someone could buy silk so that they could start up their business that was working with silk textiles. And I just thought that was awesome, because that is the type of thing that happens every day. But perhaps we don't often think about it in the context of women's work, for one thing, but as part of women's involvement in the community.
Yeah, and I think that's also a really interesting point in terms of the fact that there is a lot of intersection between women's work and women's involvement in kind of family and community. And this in part has to do, I think, with kind of gender dynamics about the situations in which women's work is actually encouraged. But I also think it speaks to the way that economic systems tended to work in the Middle Ages, that there isn't the kind of divorce between, you know, family and community on the one hand and business on the other that we might be more likely to see in a lot of contexts today.
Yeah, I think that's important. And again, it's something that you have to look at people on the ground, people, neighbors, businesses, to really see. We have these days, you know, people going to a skyscraper, for example, and perhaps there is that difference, like you're saying. Now, we need to get into money lending, I think, because people can't talk about medieval Jewish communities without talking about money lending. This is something that was part of the relationship between Jews and Christians. The Middle Ages. Can you tell us how you saw it playing out in Catalonia and maybe some of the things that we might have got wrong about it?
So the kind of standard narrative, right, is that basically Jews couldn't do anything but money lending, and that Christians aren't able to lend money at interest at all because of church prohibitions. So Jews then basically get forced into this. And then that contributes to Christians resenting them because they see their Jewish moneylenders as exploitative. So that would be the kind of standard narrative. It's pretty clear, even from the documentation that I have. So in the documentation that I have, money lending is the thing that I see the most. That is, I would say, almost certainly because money lending among both Jews and Christians is overrepresented, which, if you think about it, makes sense from the perspective of what kinds of things do you want to contract for? Yeah. If you give somebody money and would like that person to give you that money back at some point, you would like to have a nice legal written record of that. In contrast, if you know you go and buy fish from somebody and you give them cash, you don't need a contract. What would the contract be for? It's not even like you're going to return the fish. So, you know, the more kind of like long-term this, you know, business relationship is created, the more likely you are to need a contract. And loans are a pretty quintessential example of that. So loans in general are overrepresented in this documentation. That also includes loans being made by Christians. And we are pretty confident that the Christians are lending money at interest. There are some contexts in which they are able to do so if it's presented as certain kinds of, you know, if it's kind of linked with commerce in certain ways. But there are also situations in which it's just pretty common for somebody to say, I'm lending you 25 sou, and actually I'm lending you 20 sou, and I'd like you to pay me back 25 sou. That I think that is something that's just happening all the time. When you have Jewish loans, they do tend to, or often at least, they state that they are lending money at interest and will specify the interest rate. And so you often see the legal interest rate is 20% per year. And you often actually kind of see that being specified in the documentation. One of the things, first of all, that I think is striking is that there's a lot of evidence that we're not looking at relationships that are kind of constantly marked by hostility. One of the things that I found really interesting is that in Vik in particular, where there's more money lending involving Jewish women in particular, and so I really could kind of take people and do kind of deep dives into what their lending businesses look like, you see that they have repeat customers, which suggests that they have some level of trust, that why would you keep going to this particular person again and again, rather than say, well, maybe this, all the Jews are terrible, but you know, maybe this Jewish moneylender is a little better, you know, and go to that one next time, unless you have some kind of at least relatively positive relationship, or at least the transaction went well. And you felt that you could trust that person to be a, you know, reputable business person, right? So that's one of the things that I found really striking, that we have these repeat customers. We also have this sense, if you look at some of these contracts, that, you know, there is some amount of kind of friendliness and flexibility in some ways, that there are a lot of contracts in which it's, okay, so if you repay the loan by this period, they actually won't charge interest. The interest only kicks in after this point, which they're not required by law to, you know, to have that. That seems like, you know, something that they're kind of making the choice on, agreeing on that, either to make it seem like a better deal or improve relationships, that they're kind of making the choice really to do that to some extent. We also see a lot of renegotiation of loan contracts, that in practice, you know, we see the terms that are kind of set out at the beginning, but that there is flexibility and negotiation. We're not looking at situations in which, you know, they're going to be rushing to, you know, take your house or a pound of your flesh.
Yeah.
Because you haven't paid the loan back in 6 months, that, you know, they're going to go and negotiate that and say, okay, well, here's the terms for you repaying this loan in a year. So yeah, there's a lot of ways in which that therefore looks really different from what you might traditionally anticipate. The other thing is that you also might expect that because, you know, money lending is this quintessentially, you know, Jewish thing, or is perceived as such, you might expect that Jewish women are going to be more active as money lenders than Christian women, and they're not. That in fact, Christian women are extending a larger proportion of the loans made by Christians than Jewish women usually are of the loans made by Jews. With, I will just add, the really fascinating exception of Vik, where it's this, you know, small new community that it seems like basically just as it got started, they just did things really differently. In part, I think because they had these kind of founding families where the women were the ones who were doing the lending. And that kind of carries on for a couple of generations. So that you actually have in the first couple of decades, it's in the 1260s, like 40% of Jewish loans are actually being made by women. Starts dropping down, but through the 1330s, it stays kind of hovering around 10%, whereas in Barcelona and Girona, we're seeing more like 2%, to kind of give you a sense of how striking this is.
Yeah, in the book, you're suggesting that there's a sense that this is something that husbands should do, that men should do. So this is not really something that Jewish women, reputable Jewish women, should necessarily do.
Right.
But then there is a big exception that happens when the husbands start to drop dead. So can you tell us what happens in Barcelona after the Black Death arrives?
Right. So that's the other thing that's interesting about Vík, is that the women that you see are often married women, whereas in general, in other contexts, the women you see are widows. And then one of the really fascinating things that happens after the Black Death, especially in Barcelona, is, well, it simply seems to be that there are a lot more widows than there used to be. Mm-hmm. And that's a place where the proportion of Jewish loans that are made by women jumps from 2% to 20%. So again, you're seeing something pretty drastic. And so the timing, very clearly the Black Death matters here. The other thing that I argue matters here is the fact that there are also massacres of the Jewish community in Barcelona. So in terms of kind of trying to figure out, you know, what is explaining this dynamic, part of it could be that in terms of something like the Black Death, it might be that there often is an age disparity between husbands and wives, and that there's at least some possibility that people who are somewhat older might have been somewhat more susceptible to the Black Death. And this might just be creating a lot more young widows in particular, widows who either don't have children or whose children are still minors. And so, you know, there are more of those. But the other, I think, big possibility is that because basically the men are out in public more, they're more likely to have been killed in these massacres.
Yeah, I think that's really important to remember, and something that you've come across in the records, right? You've seen at least one Jewish husband was killed for host desecration, which I would be willing to bet was not a thing that actually happened. He was just a victim of hatred.
Yeah. It's this poor woman. I mean, I don't know. I guess maybe not poor woman. Maybe she didn't like either of her husbands. But the first husband dies sometime in the context of the Black Death. It's not clear whether that's of plague or in these massacres. But that's, you know, she loses her first husband in this context. And then her second, then she remarries. Then her second husband is one of three Jews who is executed in Barcelona for a false accusation of host desecration. Mm-hmm. So she really did not have a lot of luck keeping husbands alive.
I can't imagine what that time was like for anybody, but especially for the Jewish communities, especially in the areas around the Mediterranean that were, well, and in Germany as well. I mean, Sofia Barzilai has been looking at that. We had a podcast about that a few weeks ago. But one of the things I think is interesting in that instance is that women are able to step into that role and lend money without any problems because they understand the rules and they know how to do it. So it's not as if they were completely unfamiliar with it. And I think to me, this is one of those things where you get to see evidence of that invisible training that has been happening for years, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That it's kind of impossible to assume that they're not doing something behind the scenes, right? That they're involved in, you know, the bookkeeping or something like that. So that they have at least some of the kind of basic skills. You know, the kind of big difference is this public appearance in front of the notary, which, you know, you get the sense is potentially kind of daunting for some people, you know, having to do that as a kind of constant everyday thing. That you have this woman, right, who, for example, you know, is doing this for about a year and then basically is like, I'm going to go get married. And we honestly don't know, right? I mean, we don't know if, you know, this is something that she preferred. We don't know if she's pressured into this. It's very hard to know exactly what the dynamics were at play here. But
yeah, I think there's so much richness that we will never actually be able to touch, which is so unfortunate for us, but we know it's there. And I think that your book has really been able to pull these things out of the records. And I'm really, really glad that you've brought together ideas of women's work, not only being the physical work that they do in the marketplace or at home, but this work that they're doing where they're going to the notary, they're making loans, they're investing in things. This is all work. It's all legit.
Yeah.
And it's all stuff that's being done by Christian women and Jewish women in these areas. Now, I mentioned at the beginning that you're also a podcaster. So tell us about your podcast, which is doing really well. Tell us about what the podcast is all about.
Yeah, so the podcast is something of a kind of different hat from an academic perspective. So the podcast is called Media Evil, a medieval pop culture podcast. And it looks at pop cultural representations of the Middle Ages, including both historical fiction and medieval inspired fantasy. And I've done usually movies, but I'll do sometimes TV series. I will do books. I've done Medieval Times Restaurant. So a kind of a variety of different things. And thinks about, you know, what they do well or not so well in terms of accuracy and what they tell us overall in terms of how modern people think about the medieval past. Yeah, my most recent episode is actually on, or at least at the time of recording, is on the recent film Catherine Called Birdie.
Right. I haven't seen that one, but I've heard good things about it.
I had very ultimately sort of, I loved the book when I was a kid, and the movie for me didn't quite hold up to my fond feelings about the book, unfortunately.
To be fair, I've heard good things from non-medievalists, so maybe that makes a difference. But I have to ask you, do you have a favorite medieval movie? What's your favorite?
Probably Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
A classic.
Yes, a classic. For something that I would say is kind of a little bit less well known, I will also recommend The Little Hours, which is inspired by a couple of stories from the Decameron and is about some, I would say, not particularly traditionally religious nuns.
That's a good way of putting it.
That's the G-rated way of putting it.
So for people that want to find your podcast, where should they find it? I'll give them links as well, but can you tell us where to find your podcast?
Yeah. So if you search that name, Media Evil, it's available on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, pretty much all podcasting platforms, with the host site being SoundCloud.
Awesome. And I will give people links to your book as well as where they can follow you on Twitter. Thank you so much, Sarah, for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me. This is a lot of fun.
To find out more about Sarah's work, you can follow her on Twitter at Sarah Ift Decker. Her podcast is Media Evil, a medieval pop culture podcast, and her new book is The Fruit of Her Hands, Jewish and Christian Women's Work in Medieval Catalan Cities.
Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. What's up, Peter?
Hey. Well, have you heard the words, "Blessed are the rich, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are they that have, for they shall not be empty-handed. Blessed are they that have money, for theirs is the Curia of Rome."
No, I haven't heard that. I've heard blessed are the poor, and I've heard blessed are the cheesemakers, but I've never heard of blessed are the rich. What is this from?
It's something called the Money Gospel.
I need to read that.
Yeah. I came across it. It's really popular. It kind of dates from the 13th century. Lots of versions of it, but it's this parody, really making fun of the Pope and cardinals. So much fun. So I have to post about that.
That's amazing. I think there's probably lots of advice for us in there, right? How to get rich. I think we could all read that these days.
Well, don't be poor. That's the main thing.
Okay.
So we've got that. Plus, we have this piece on this beautiful, like, Tudor era heart-shaped pendant. It's just been discovered. It's now in the British Museum. It was found in England. And had the first letters H and K on it. And they pretty much figured it's for Henry VIII and Catherine of Aragon. It's really nice, but it's also kind of cheaply made.
Oh.
Parts of it are really good, but is shoddy craftsmanship. So they think it was one of many that were given out as prizes by Henry and Catherine. Something to show off, but not keep for too long.
Oh, I see. Yeah, because it looks beautiful and it's massive. It's absolutely massive.
Yeah, it's just wonderful. But they're like, here it is. And you show it off for a day or so, and then you forget about it.
Or you keep it in a chest forever, and you tell your grandkids about the time that you saw Catherine and Henry when they were still together, right?
Yeah, exactly. It probably lost its appeal around 1530s. So.
Yeah. But five later, you're looking back on it going, should I still have this in my house?
I really wish Catherine stayed with Henry.
She is a pretty amazing woman.
Indeed. Oh, but Tudors are always like fun to talk about. You know, it's just a lovely little piece.
Awesome.
So yeah, we've got that, more news and articles. And yeah, we're doing lots of new medieval books.
Great. And I've been seeing those on your social media, right? Are you doing posts about them or just social media?
We're doing posts about them, but you know, we also want to do photos, show off a little of the content on that. Our Instagram is becoming more and more books.
Well, there is nothing wrong with that.
Indeed.
Well, thank you, Peter, for stopping by to tell us what's on the website.
Thanks.
Thank you, as always, to all of you patrons on Medievalist.net's Patreon page, whose generosity helps to support my podcast and the work of other indie writers and podcasters who contribute to their website. Patrons can access all sorts of goodies like subscriptions to the Medieval Magazine and Medieval World Magazine, as well as ad-free versions of this podcast. To become a patron yourself, please visit patreon.com/medievalists. For everything from women to swimming, follow medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. You can find me, Danielle Sapolsky, on social media at 5MIN Medievalist or 5 Minute Medievalist. And you can find my books at all your favorite bookstores, where you can get hold of How to Live Like a Monk, Medieval Wisdom for Modern Life, in hardcover, ebook, and audiobook. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks for listening, and have yourself a wonderful day.